I want to welcome you to this workshop today, and of course it's about policing. And what we're talking about is really the use of the police and or the military to control various populations. And I think it would be very helpful just to make a comparison between what has happened in Baltimore with Freddie and what has happened very recently with the killing of someone in Yemen, reputed to be a member of Al-Qaeda. My co-panelist here, I'm very honored actually to have them be with me because of their experience. And Deborah Sweet, who is the director of World Can't Wait, has been very much involved with the stop and frisk struggle in New York City, including being arrested and being supportive of, in a very practical ways, people who have been arrested. And facing jail, and of course Deborah has a wide experience in other kinds of organizing around anti-imperialism and against militarization. And I'm also really pleased that Kathy Kelly could be out of jail.
Yay.
To be here today. Kathy has been arrested, I think at least four times, been to jail, three, maybe this is the fourth time, around drone warfare. But she also has had a very powerful witness over, you know, more than a decade of being in those places where war is going on to stand with the people who are under attack, largely by the United States of America. As Lyndon Johnson would say. Her perspective, I think, on Afghanistan is very much from the ground with the people there, a people who are also being policed by the United States and their so-called allies. So I'm going to ask both of them to speak from their personal experience about what policing looks like, what it means to the people who are under police control. I have, and I just will read very briefly, similarities that I see between targeted killing, which includes not only drone attacks, but attacks by organized government-supported death squads. This is, as with Freddie Gray, killing without due process, and I don't believe in the death penalty, but some people do, and due process means without having anyone had to go to court and being an opportunity to defend themselves. Killing with no accountability. Killing with no reparations for the families of the victims. I know that in Chicago recently there was an attempt to get reparations for the victims of a police killing. Another thing is the willingness to constantly violate the rights of privacy of the community, which of course would include stop and frisk. But with the drone, it means following people 24/7, endlessly, week in and week out. There's a willingness to believe that the government and their agents have the right to occupy a community without the consent of the community. And there's a willingness to terrorize a community through killing or other abuse. And there's a belief on the part of the government and their agents that they are superior based on color, ethnicity, religion, class, income, or sexual preference. And finally, there's the belief that those who are under attack are relatively powerless to stop the attacks and to protect themselves. So part of what we're going to talk about is not only what is going on the ground, but what we may do practically to try to oppose these behaviors. So Deborah, with that, please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Nick. This is really special to be here with Kathy. I just want to emphasize to all who see this that there are not that many people on the globe who really understand what the U.S. is doing, particularly with the targeted killing, and are willing to put their lives on the line and on hold to protest it. And Kathy and several other people have. It's very precious to the people that we have that. So it's good to spend time with you. Nick and Kathy and I and several hundred other people around the country, maybe thousands, but I think hundreds is accurate, have been working on the issue of targeted killing since at least 2009, since the Obama program of targeted killing and the secret CIA program and the U.S. military program of drone strikes began. And I just wanted to note something before I forget this. Nick, and what you were saying about due process, this is a huge question, but I just want to take you back to 2 years ago when Eric Holder, who was the Attorney General till last week, made a point after Obama spoke about due process. Holder says, okay, but I just want to make the point that due process is not necessarily judicial process. In other words, we're going to do shit. It's not necessarily going to go through the judicial system. We're going to do shit, and we're going to call it due process. And this is, I think, metaphorically very useful. Since Nick wanted us to talk personally, I will say that it was in mid-August of 1968, I was 16, I think, I first saw the body of an unarmed young black man who had been killed by the police. And I went to that funeral, and in my youth, I thought, this is a unique experience. I have to remember it. Didn't turn out to be a unique experience at all. Now we're looking at a situation where, as best as we can tell, even though the federal government does not keep these records, this increase of the killing by police of unarmed people is increasing. It's over 100 in 2015. I think people know some of these stories, but holding these stories in your heart and your brain and processing it and understanding the continuity that this represents of occupying army in the U.S. in whole communities and occupying armies that have gone around the world. You know, why? Because the commanders are racist? Well, in many cases, I'm sure. But it's a system. And I guess this is the thing I really want to grapple with, all of us. We have to grapple with the system that does this with impunity around the world, that is essentially the system that's got legitimacy in this country. And until we, the people, create a situation where there's no legitimate use of force by this government, you know, whether it's the city of Baltimore or whether it's the U.S. state projecting 1,200 bases around the world, the most well-funded, expensive, biggest armed military in the history of the world by a factor of many times. Until we delegitimize that by our actions, our work, our talking to people, our exposure, including of the very personal stories, this is going to continue because it is morphing. You know, Loretta takes over from Eric Holder. What's the essential difference? One president takes over from another. There's different forms, But we, you know, it was a little ironic, I guess. Ray McGovern noticed when he was just speaking, he's wearing an Arrest Bush t-shirt, which many of us wore, and I even bought t-shirts that say crimes are crimes no matter who does them. I brought t-shirts that do have Bush and Obama on it. But who's the next? You know, we're in a situation now where it's very likely we're going to have a very effective war criminal in the form of Hillary Clinton, or, you know, in my opinion, even more likely that we're going to have a completely lunatic Republican who has no boundaries. And what are we thinking about in terms of this? I think it's very, very important that we're doing as much interaction with people as we can. And I just want to say, because I get these emails about 3 times a week, you guys are doing a lot of protests. Protests don't do any good. All right, well, what happened last Friday in Baltimore? Does anybody here think, seriously, could you make an argument that those 6 cops would not have been indicted without not only street protests, you know, but an uprising? Mm-hmm. Same thing with Ferguson. It wasn't successful there, but it has now created a situation in this country where at least tens of millions of people consciously look at what the police do and say, I don't know if I believe you. Just because you're a cop, I don't know if I believe you. Now, we have a lot more to do on that. But the dynamic has been changed by people being in the streets in a way that's been much more diverse and mixed than it had been. I've been in this movement to stop police murder for many decades, and it hasn't been tons of NYU students pouring into the street. That is new. That's never been the case. We are also confronting, and I just want to raise this as my last point, that while there are tens of millions of people in the U.S. really questioning the legitimacy right now of what the police are doing, there aren't very many people actively working on and questioning the legitimacy of what the U.S. is doing around the world. How many people know what the U.S. is doing in the whole continent of Africa, in Somalia and the Sudan and the penetration of AFRICOM? How many people really understand that there's been no end to the war in Afghanistan, that Pakistan and now Yemen. Nobody knows where Yemen is. I'm not dissing people in the U.S., but it's a very poor country. You know, it does not have an Olympic team and any Olympic stars, and people just don't know. But this has now become a real battleground. And don't think, please, that what Saudi Arabia is doing in having killed thousands of people now and made homeless hundreds of thousands of people in Yemen is in any way disconnected from what the U.S. is funding directly. You know, they sold them cluster bombs. They're using cluster bombs. Didn't we learn this in Vietnam, right? Napalm, Agent Orange, cluster bombs. All of these are anti-personnel weapons, anti the people that are living there, tearing up people's bodies, tearing up their lives because, you know, as Nick introduced, there is a creation of these are the other, these are people that don't feel human emotions like we do, that don't care about their dead. All of this really deeply, deeply by those of us who want to stop these wars has to be challenged. I have some ideas about doing that, but that's a conversation we all can have.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Kathy. Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Nick. I suppose for people who've been out on these street corners many, many times demonstrating, we've all heard somebody either drive by or walk by and say with high contempt, get a job! Jobs, jobs, jobs. And in no way do I want to say, especially after just coming from a federal prison where some of the prisoners who were close to being released were also in a panic because what are they going to do? They don't have a job. They're homeless. I don't at all want to undervalue the need to have an income in this time of terrible income inequity. But I also want to say we keep preserving the need to ask what kind of work. I mean, what a terrible thing it is now that you've got undereducated people, underserved by many, many different systems in some parts of the country, finding that the only jobs they can get are the ones that work as human zookeepers in prisons or train them to kill other human beings as police officers or establish so-called security based on threat and force. And the people whom they are locking up in the prison system are very often people who are in the same boat, undereducated and underserved, maybe in some of the northern, more urban areas. But this is itself, I think, is a terrible travesty that we keep on saying, yes, get a job, jobs, 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 but we don't ask ourselves very much about what kind of work is developing as the source of available income. Well, it's really a parallel, I think, in Afghanistan. Because there you have people who not only are wanting income, they're desperate for the basics, the food, water, survival. And so what income is coming into the neighborhoods? Where are the jobs available? Where is there some way to make some money? Well, when the United States military comes forward with billions and billions of dollars, then lo and behold, people start becoming very interested in security jobs. There's an extremely fine book called No Good Men Among the Living by Anand Gopal. And Deborah and I were both commenting that we'd had a chance to read it. And I strongly recommend this for understanding more about the process of how these various militias are created. Anand Gopal says, understand how a United States military base is formed, and you'll understand the infrastructure for much of the militarism that develops. And what quite often happens is that people discover that they can get some kind of income if they align themselves with some aspect of United States military intervention in their country. Now, this can take many different routes. In fact, Anatole Levin, who writes for the New York Review of Books, said that the United States, by pouring its money into protection for U.S. bases, protection for U.S. troops, has actually been filling the pockets of the Taliban because protection rackets develop. People go to the U.S. bases and say, hey, if you want that convoy that's the only means to bring supplies into your base to travel from point A to point B, there's a price. And if you don't want us to torch that convoy overnight or kill your drivers, you'll have to pay for that. So believe it or not, the cost for 1 gallon of gasoline in Afghanistan, used by the U.S. military for airborne or landborne vehicles, rose to $800 per gallon. And who's paying for that? And here we are, in our streets, in our neighborhoods, not able to get the basics that are needed for people to survive. Now, I just want to make a quick parallel in terms of the concept, I suppose, of extrajudicial assassination, of targeting another person. I don't think I'm seeing very much difference between a drone that does surveillance and a decision made by the kill team in Oskaloosa, Florida, working in conjunction with people who are behind consoles and dimly lit trailers in places like Creech Air Force Base, operating drones, and then either operating weaponized drones or calling in Crayola helicopters. But a high-value target is selected, and the drone operation becomes judge, jury, and executioner. Extrajudicial assassination. Is there not a very, very similar parallel when an armed security person in the United States sees a person of color running down the street or walking down the street or maybe standing still, decides this person is a threat to somebody's security, and kills the person? And the more that we exalt the policing forces and the military forces in our society, the more we leave ourselves, I believe, very, very vulnerable to a rise toward fascism and a reenactment of systems of enslavement. Well,
right.
So if I could just go back to this process as it develops in Afghanistan. I did take a few notes, and forgive me for not memorizing this, but I'm getting older. 60 to 80,000 armed private security employees, almost all of them working now for Afghan strongmen, are on the dole of somebody who's paying them salaries to work as security guards. There are 195,000 Afghan army soldiers, 110,000 police, and tens of thousands of private militiamen working, the militiamen, the private ones, for the Afghan government, the CIA, and the U.S. Special Forces. So this leaves us with 300,000 Afghan people dependent on United States patronage to pay them some kind of income to give security for some kind of grouping of United States occupation in Afghanistan, along with the Afghan army and these special Afghan policing groups, especially one that General Petraeus was very invested in starting all over the country, called the Afghan Local Police. So when you're in Afghanistan, I've spent quite a good deal of time in Kabul. The young people we know are afraid to go home and visit their own families if they're anywhere outside of Kabul. Kabul is now referred to as Kabubul, because beyond Kabul, the roadways, the areas are controlled in 70% of the country by the Taliban. After all these years since 2001 of the United States being in Afghanistan, saying that it's going to make Afghanistan a more secure country, 70% of the country is under the control of the Taliban. And the drone surveillance, which is 24/7, doesn't seem to elicit much commentary on the fact that 80 to 90% of the world's opium is going right on out of Afghanistan. The idea of being trapped by the United States military presence is especially brought forth in a particular quote, which I'd like to share with you, from page 221 of Anand Gopal's book. And he's been talking about a man named Hazarat, who was trying to help protect his own small village. And there was a killing of civilians in the village. And Hazarat said U.S. officials announced that the dead were mostly militants. But villagers showed Anand Gopal photos of bloodied, lifeless women and old men. Hazarat railed, "When you go back to America, give Obama a message. You say you'll give us roads and schools. I don't give a shit about your roads and schools. I want safety for my family." But is safety for their families, for our families, predicated in being able to have more weapons and more guns and more airborne surveillance and more air assault capacity than someone else? Imagine the reservoir of goodwill that the United States could have built up by now if, in fact, our main export, instead of being weapons, was the wherewithal for people to survive, for people to be able to get clean water, to get food, to get some kind of education in their communities. Right now, the numbers of children under age 5 in Afghanistan suffering from severe acute malnourishment numbers 517,000, 750,000 people enduring prolonged displacement in Afghanistan. And this during a stretch of years from 2001 to the present, where the amount of money which the United States poured into Afghanistan for non-military assistance amounted to $104 billion, more than was spent on the Marshall Plan. So the surveillance that the drones bring to us doesn't give us the information that we need, I don't think, by even the largest stretch of the imagination. I am very, very fortunate to be part of a group, and mainly just to listen to a group of youngsters. After all my years of teaching high school, I never thought I'd find 15 teenagers being my main mentors in life, but these are the Afghan peace volunteers, and they're a very sturdy, staunch group who say blood does not wipe away blood, blood does not wash out blood. And they're dedicated to trying to control their own desires for revenge and retaliation, understandable desires given the traumas that they've survived. And they also want to try to do what they can within their own scope to break the cycles of violence. They do not agree with the United States occupation. Tell us, go back and tell the parents in your country, don't send your sons and your daughters over here. It's very dangerous for them, and they're not particularly helping us. They are taken by the Colombian example of the autonomous zone, the apartado in Colombia, where people are trying to say, we want to carve out a zone of existence for ourselves wherein we don't pick up arms for any particular group, where we don't become involved in armed struggle, but where we can try to build some kind of security for ourselves and those who join us in being able to share resources, live simply, and resist injustices. So they've been very brave. I mean, these young men, in spite of threats from religious authorities and even warlords, put on the burqa, head to toe burqa, and walked down a public thoroughfare in Kabul. You know, their big shoes were showing. And there were immediate threats from religious authorities, from security authorities, and from one particular warlord, such that the little center that they've got to help teach some of the street kids a kind of alternative school, remedial math and language, had to be shut down, the place where they organized making the big heavy blankets so that people won't starve over the winter. Everything had to kind of go on hold. But this is the kind of bravery that they've shown as they have tried very, very hard to be in touch with internationals, not organized by internationals, but trying to go forward undaunted. Jobs, jobs, jobs. We do indeed have a great deal of work to do. But I think the pendulum might be coming undone. We might be seeing a time when more and more people are beginning to recognize, as was said very effectively by a number of people this morning, that the empire is in decline. These empires don't go down quietly. So our job, our main job, I believe, our work is to try to create the kind of community wherein it's easier to be good.
Thank you.
Well, this is called a workshop, okay? And so I think that you might want to ask some questions, but I also would like for people to bring forward ideas that they have about how to address things in their own community or what's been raised here. I just would like to say that I think it's possible that we can view the United States as a fascist state now because it is a global power killing and repressing people in the world. And my feeling is that as the empire declines, the amount of repression within the United States may increase. And so part of the struggle is to see how do we respond. Is it a violent response? Is it a response by these younger people? But I would really ask people in the room to share their experience.
Yes, my name is Joanne Farrell. I am from Occupy. I've worked with Occupy Albany and Occupy Wall Street. And I formed a group called Democratize the Economy, and it addressed poverty around the world and how it's affecting Americans that were outsourcing so many jobs. And none of our stuff is made here. So much of our products are almost 90%, more than 90% of our products are made overseas. And 11 million manufacturers in the United States create 12 million jobs. So I've tried to push the issue that we have participated in that, each and all of us and ourselves. We see the labels when it says Vietnam, we know that's not here. Bangladesh, we know it's not here. We know there's a reason, because they don't have to follow labor laws, they don't have to follow environmental laws, and they're exploiting and abusing people. And we need to take responsibility for the lack of jobs by not participating and not buying all this foreign-made crap that we know little girls overseas are making for 6 and 8 and 10 cents an hour. Bangladesh went up, first it was 6 cents after the factories collapsed and there was fires and women died, young girls died. well, it's almost 2 years ago now, that Bangladesh women stormed through the streets and said they had enough. Since then, it went from 6 to 10, from 10 to 28 cents, and I don't know the latest current exact amount, so I won't quote it. But that's the kind of change they can make in their own country. But we have to change what we buy. We have to change what we're doing to the planet. And what I see with a lot of people is they don't want to change their lifestyle. And I think that would be a huge difference. I also wanted to say I totally agree with you about the fascism and growing in this country to the point I'm starting to feel afraid. And I've never felt afraid of my government. I grew up in a time where it's like, we used to say, oh, China, you can't say anything about your government there. We can say anything about our government here. We can't no longer do that. And I feel, as an activist, I have become afraid when I look at the bulletin board out front and I see all the names of the peace activists that have been arrested. That's frightening. And I'll share with you one experience I had. I've been arrested 8 times as a protester. And one of the times, it was on May Day, and there was a female cop who was told to look through my bag that they'd already searched. And she had something in her hand, and she kept looking like she was gonna drop something in my bag. And on another occasion, I had been, was going through the checkpoint at the Capitol of New York State, the Capitol building. And the same female cop and her co-worker or accomplice, if I can use that term, tried it again. And they put something in my bag as they're checking everyone. And then they said, she has to wait. And I had witnesses to this. And they're like, we see something, we see something. I said, you don't see anything on me because I'm, you know, my age and there's nothing I do, okay? And they kept x-raying the bag and re-x-raying the bag. And then a little baggie fell out on the floor and the girl kicked it and said, oh, well, you can go. And they let me go. I never forgot that. I worked in education.
Excuse me.
So I'm just finishing up. I worked in education and that could destroy me. And right. that's all I wanted to say. That's a situation where they could ruin my life with a false arrest.
Right. Well, I guess, you know, personally, I would say I think we have to understand that that's part of the price to pay for, you know, doing the work we do. And I, for myself, have made a personal decision not to in any way temper my commentary or my means of communication because of what the government may or may not do. I think this is where we are. And if we get into that situation of acting on our fears to shut our mouths, then we're pretty much done for. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question for Deborah. You mentioned the difficulty of getting people in the streets, and I'm wondering what successes, I mean, what do you say, is there something in particular you say that has worked to get people in the streets?
I think people come out in the street when, A, they feel something is completely intolerable. There's a chance of stopping it. And I don't have any explanation for you for Ferguson, but I do know that I was on Twitter the day that Michael Brown was left laying, his body was left laying for 4.5 hours. And I did pick up on Twitter that image. And I don't know, I just felt when I saw that, this is going to be big. Something's going to happen. But it was the people from Ferguson that came out on the street then. Nobody came in from outside. All of us outsiders were not there. They stood up. And the whole world saw it, largely because of social media. The same thing with Freddie. My understanding is that people were very much consciously looking to Ferguson and what had happened in New York around Eric Garner. And yeah, all of that is welling up, and it's just too much. I think, just if I could just for a moment bring up the book that I meant to mention. And I loved Anand Gopal's book, No Good Men Among the Living. But this is Edward Baptiste, who just came out with this book last year, The Half That Has Never Been Told. And I think it's the best of the new crop of books on slavery that I have read. And the reason I'm bringing this up is when we are out on the streets right now, and it is very good, all these kids are coming out. But I'm finding even myself, and I've tried to study this, being really astonished at what's in this book in particular. This is how slavery, the U.S. system of chattel slavery, built the U.S. into a superpower. This is not, slavery, yeah, that was so 19th century. This is how this whole system applied within the U.S. and these colonies made an unchallengeable superpower, partially through accident, but through exploitation in a very systematic way. Didn't happen in Brazil, and there were a lot more African people enslaved in Brazil. It happened here for some particular reasons. And there's no person living in this country that right now doesn't have to grapple with what it means that there's still a system of enslavement. There's a system in place where black people, brown people, you know, do not have the rights accorded to a white person. It's just not true that there's no great disparity. And so are we, you know, I write to tens of thousands of people every week in the World Can't Wait email list, and I hope some of you are on that list, but I get answers often to people writing back about the war, but I don't get answers back from the base of supporters much about what happened in Ferguson, what's happening in Baltimore, and I'm really struggling with why.
Well, could I ask, we have black people in the room here, and I would like to ask your perception of and commentary on what we've been talking about. I think you had your hand up.
First of all, let me not even say that I represent black people. Okay. There is a multiplicity of viewpoint and position.
I wasn't asking you to do
I
that.
I understand, no problem. I also want to thank you, thank the conference and the panel for raising these questions. And I want to try to just run through these few points
Please.
Very quickly in order to leave time for other people. I appreciate that and that I got called on right now as you have raised what has been very clear to many people who are activists and have studied the history of the United States. It is that the United States is in the position of wealth, not only the United States, but the West, in its position of wealth because of indirect relationship to and because the effect of the existence of chattel slavery in this country. Right. Having said that there needs to be a change. I agree with many of the, in fact, all of the short-term points that the panel has raised, the question of fascism, the question of white supremacy, all of these immediate questions. But I also think that there needs to be a fundamental change in the assumptions about the nature of the United States and its relationship to the populations within this country. Mm-hmm. And that it is not a we. This is not a we. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The United States is an imperialist state, not only because of what it does around the world, but what it does right here. Mm-hmm. And it has a colonial relationship with black people who have been enslaved inside this country in terms of what is now called institutionalized racism. But it is a colonial relationship. It is also a colonial relationship with the brown people who are inside of this country. And when that social, economic, political relationship is teased out, then you begin to look at how the various systems react and relate, not only in terms of what happens inside with those populations of people, but also in terms of our white allies and comrades who are part of the what might be called the oppressor nation. And so it is not our communities that are safe, it's your community that is safe. Mine has never been. I remember even in being 15 years old on Long Island and the murder of Larry Blaylock in Roosevelt, Long Island, when we resisted. So this question of the role of the police has always and forever been the role of an occupying force. And when we resisted, then they brought the drugs in. The iron fist and the velvet glove. There is a direct relationship between the question of drugs coming into the country and its use. The same way there were the opium wars in China, there's the drug war here. Moving on. So that this question of mercenaries and how the impact of the U.S. military in Afghanistan, same thing here. You got folks who are going over there because they can't find a job here. So they'll agree to be a mechanic and make hundreds of thousands of dollars to be a mechanic or in connected with the U.S. military, where they would never consider that before, but they could not find a job here, so they considered going, and what they're called, what here? Contractors. No, they're mercenaries. Mercenaries. Last, third point. Anti-war. We got to get past fighting against systems, mechanized systems or weapon systems. I worked for American Service Committee. At that time, in the mid-80s, it was the B-52 bomber. Oh, we gotta go against the B-52 bomber. Then it was whatever the latest nuclear weapons, whatever, whatever. Now it's drones. It is simply the latest development of technology. We gotta oppose all of it. As Glenn Ford said, the weapon systems develop out of the development of technology of imperialism. If you don't deal with this question of this cause of this thing in the first place, you're going to be running after system after system after system after system. You're going to have an anti-war movement that's going to raise the latest country, the latest this, the latest that, but you haven't dealt with the crux of it. And this is why people call this the beast here. Please. And this panel did not make the mistake. I want to raise this point. I want to raise it for the entire conference. They are not simply just young black men who are being shot down the street. They are young black men, women, and children. Mm-hmm. There are lists and lists of women who are being shot down in the streets and nobody is talking about it. There are men, women, and children. Do not fall into the kind of patriarchal thinking, the divide and conquer thinking that is being projected out here. And lastly, again, I intentionally started with a thank you for the panel and clearly agree with many of the points. However, changing the difference in a perspective in terms of the view of how do we deal with the nature of the United States. But however, even in this conference, even in this panel, the composition of this panel, I don't doubt any sincerity. Please understand where I'm coming from. But to be the spokesperson for Stop and Frisk, where are the young black men on this panel? We are the people who
well, we
are
did
active.
We did invite a Reverend Sekou and he couldn't make it.
I understand the intention, but the end result is that the composition of the panel still is not reflective.
But may I add that when I agreed to be on the panel, my understanding was that Reverend Sekou was on the panel.
That's one person out of four, and please don't be defensive about the point I'm making. I am not doubting their sincerity, the experiences, okay, the thought put into analyzing your experience, your courage. No question about that at all. But I do raise that when we walk in here and we're talking about the globalization of the police force, state terror, the victims, the actual continuing daily victims of that state terror, whether it's within the so-called U.S. borders or outside the border, their voice is not here, okay? And that is not a criticism of you individually. It's a criticism of how, when people talk about the anti-war movement, it's got to be, we've got to deal with the crux of the matter and make space for the voice of the people who are actively being affected. And when that comes forward, when those people come forward, then that question of who's out in the street, who's out in the street gets addressed. Those people, that's who will lead that and set the tone and the direction. Again, this is not a personal criticism. It's not a criticism of courage. I applaud it. I respect it. I thank you for it and for the good information that you have put forward. But we have to challenge, okay, the movements inside of this country to be more reflective of the actual nature of oppression that exists in this country. And thank you for the time.
Thank you. Okay, we're really close to noon. We're going to go a little bit over, if that's okay. Is that all right with everyone? Okay, yes, ma'am.
Okay, I want to thank you for so much of what you said. I teach high school art in a community that has two prisons, 20 miles south.
That has
two prisons.
Okay.
It has a I think a state and a county and a state.
Where are you?
Cooksacking, New York. It's the home of Cooksacking Bunnies. And what I find teaching, it is so difficult, and it is difficult among the teachers too. And as many of you know, the teachers, in New York State at least, and I think teachers all over the country are under really oppressed teachers, and people are starting to come out, left, right, middle, everybody's starting to realize that teachers are being slammed. Yes. But my point is, this community, the kids, the biggest jobs in this community are the corrections officers.
That's right.
And also, when I first started teaching there 13 years ago, it was maybe 3 or 4% people of color. It has moved up to about 14-15% people of color. So I'm starting to see as a teacher, you know, keeping your place, make sure you keep your place to the kids that are in there. But my main point,
what did you mean by that? Keep your place?
Well, that, you know, like, if that they tend to be slammed more discipline-wise. If they're
Absolutely.
Out in the hall making noise, mm-hmm. and we have retired corrections officers as the hall monitors. Mm-hmm. We have police in this school district. I mean, there's 500 kids in the high school. It's a rural, very rural community. But one of my main points is that part of the whole thing, a lot of these people in this district are very, very poor. But they're very poor white, and they live on this, we're better. Mm-hmm. We're better just because we're white. And so we have to stop that so many of the people, they use that. They use their white people who are poor and are also being oppressed from fighting the system because they might see, I mean, there's a teacher in this, and I won't talk much longer, but there was a teacher in the faculty room the other day, and we were talking about Ferguson. Actually, forgive me, I've forgotten his name.
Trayvon Marshall?
I can't breathe. And
Eric Garner.
And the woman said, but he was resisting arrest. And I said, did you watch the video? Did you even watch the video? And it's like these people, the whole community is under this whole, and I think my school district, I think the community is a little bit of a petri dish to work on how can we play with this. And I'm not being conspiratorial. I really honestly believe it after 13 years.
It's not just there.
And I know of other communities where it's similar. So it's, watching out where the white community is being trained to sustain the system is something else that I do think we have to watch out for. So thank you.
Thanks, ma'am.
Are there any other points? Ma'am, did you have your hand up or?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'll just make, if I have time, I'll make one small, short point. I think what I feel is that people need to start to really make the connections between the militarization of the police and the militarization abroad. And because I think we can talk and talk, but we have to have strategizing sessions. How are we going to address this? Because that's part of the empire building, but it affects so many people. It's killing human beings. It's not simply taking over territories. So I think the drones, as we pointed out, the drones are no different than these handguns and whatever that the police carry and the pistols and now cluster bombs. It's all the same picture, in my view.
I just wanted to make a quick point, and it might seem really like trivial, but I feel like it's really important to watch the language that we use, and I think we need to stop referring to the 1% as rich, because it's fake, basically, to, you know, to we're measuring them according to man-made paper money, which I just see it as fake, and so if we refer to them as rich, I just think of it as fake. It's not real. They're not really wealthy, and I just believe in calling a spade, and we need to stop referring to them as rich and powerful, because I think they're anything but that.
Okay. Are there any other comments? Yes, ma'am.
Matt, I do have an observation. This is my first time at this conference.
Yeah.
And the one of the first things that I noticed was that there is a lack of youth. And this is not a criticism. This is just an observation of someone just coming in and looking. And it's like, I want to kind of reiterate something, a point that the sister up here made in regards to what's happening now in our communities is nothing new. You know, it's nothing new. We just have had the luxury of having social media outlets and technology that has put these issues on Front Street.
Yeah.
But before there was social media and before there was technology, we were getting killed every day. Nameless individuals that we would never know. You know, we were being policed, you know, and watched and observed and harassed, you know, so none of this is new. I mean, you can look at public housing communities where there's cameras and you can't walk the streets and young men are getting trespassing charges and being taken to jail and, you know, incarcerated and can't walk the streets and things of that nature. So none of this is new. But my question leading into the observation is, how do we engage the youth, you know, and because they're involved. And like this sister up here mentioned, you know, it's like a pot on a stove that's on boil. And sooner or later, it's going to bubble over. And that's what we're seeing. So the youth are going to get involved, and they are involved. They're the ones out in the streets. They're the ones protesting. They're the ones, you know, on Front Street, you know. So they are involved. But as far as this is concerned, I don't see it. Right. Where are they? You know, and so.
Well, how did you come to be here then?
I actually came with Phil Willeto. I'm from Richmond. I live in Richmond. I'm with the Nation of Gods and Earth in Richmond, Virginia. And I started working with Phil with the Shaco Bottom issue and the stadium struggle, opposing the stadium building in Shaco Bottom. And so the more I got involved with Phil and Anna and the defenders, the more I got involved in different things. I'm not that young. I may look young. I'm not that young, but I raised the question. I have three sons. I have three young black men who potentially are going to go out in this world and who are going to go out in this world and fight those same struggles and fight those same battles. And, you know, it's fine to all sit and talk, but that's an inherent fear of mine, that my sons will get shot down in the street. That's a reality.
Yeah. Well, I just want to make one observation about images and what you were saying about the luxury of the technology. And I'll make a comparison around Pakistan, Afghanistan, the war there. There are no images coming out of there. What we've just tried to do, a group of us, is to buy time on television in areas around drone bases, showing images of children killed by drones. Now, we were able to do that in Las Vegas and Northern California. We're going to do it around Syracuse. But in Syracuse, the cable provider does not want us to show the pictures of the children. Okay. My opinion is, as a person who has a background in journalism, is that the more images that come out, the more people will know. Now, I had an experience working in Mount Vernon, New York. That is a black-run community. We were trying to have television coverage of the city council meeting and other things that were going on in the community that were controversial. Within that community, it was very self-protective of people not wanting to air dirty laundry on television.
Right.
Now, these are deep problems, but my view is, when you spoke about the technology and the luxury of it, that we do have that, and that may be a way, on a systematic way,
yes,
that we can speak of these things that will, and get younger people to speak of these things. That's a suggestion that I had, maybe coming out of the workshop and that thing you said about luxury, because it is a revolutionary thing when people in the whole community can know what's happening at certain people. So, yes, ma'am.
I was just going to say that it's not a luxury. It's actually become, critical important tool. It didn't start, I believe, within the black community with Eric Garner or Trayvon or Ferguson. Let's go to Katrina. Mm-hmm. It's because Katrina was the first time since the 60s that the question of the relationship of black people to the state was exposed. Mm-hmm. When people saw unadulterated, when people saw black bodies bloated in the street and people left in the convention center. And then after Katrina, there was the Jenna 6. And after the Jenna 6, became Trayvon. I believe it was Trayvon was
2012,
yeah. And so there has been a building, and along with that, the development of the social media piece. So that it raises in my mind the thing of the us developing further this use and coordinating better the alternative media, the social media, you know, how do we develop this, keep this out of the corporate hands?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
And just last point, this question of solidarity between movements, besides being Muslim, I'm going to break everybody's stereotypes. I'm a Muslim. I work on labor issues. I have a big mouth. Okay, I'm a member of the Black Left Unity Network, and I was almost thrown out of my union for fighting for democracy within my union. Okay, in fact, I'm always in the doghouse. Okay,
I know that feeling.
And it's a wonderful thing.
Can you wait? Like
this prison, school to prison pipeline is what you are describing in your town. Okay, the use of the prison industrial complex not only to oppress the youth and shuttle them into Coxsackie and Greenhaven and Dannemora, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, as well as to keep you and I from talking about the common things that we are experiencing together so that we can fight together, okay? So that we can address this together, okay? So that you understand and I understand that there's some fundamental stuff that is coming from the same place, okay? But different experiences, different nations, but it is the same thing.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.